This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. This programme contains material that some listeners may find distressing and also features some strong language.
This is part one of the four-part series Addicted. In this episode, we follow the emotional journey of drug addiction and the difficulties that arise in the lives of the addict, the family and the community. It is not easy to find happiness in ourselves, and it is not possible to find it elsewhere.
Certainly, we see a lot of problems with youngsters, and for most of the drugs, it is youngsters. It's late teens, early 20s, smoking too many joints, that sort of stuff. We see a lot of that. A lot of them don't present themselves. A lot of them, it's their mother or their brother or somebody is concerned about their use, and they present to us, you know. Sometimes the patient themselves will present, but that's often just in a Friday afternoon crisis. I have to have something, doc, because I can't get any tablets for the weekend, or my supplier isn't in town and I'm going to be in trouble. And that's the way some of them will present to us. The Friday afternoon crisis bit is always extremely difficult to deal with because they're always anxious, they're always very sort of nervy, they want an instant fix to it, and that's always an extremely difficult situation because you don't have addiction services and that sort of stuff straight available to you at sort of 4:30 on a Friday. But and in that sort of situation, you may deal with it by just sort of prescribing short term for them to get them over the weekend and then see them on Monday or Tuesday and see where we can go with the problem. From there. That would sort of be not an unusual scenario, that sort of presentation. Then once you get to see them again, you've got to sort of take a history, see what their drug problem is, how much they're using. And it's a bit like people giving up cigarettes. They always underestimate or undertell exactly what they're taking. So there's a little bit in our brain sort of saying, yeah, they're telling me they're doing this, but they're probably doing a bit more, you know. And so depending on how serious the problem is, then we would either try and start a sort of detox-com support program based in the community, or we might decide that they need referral on to sort of other services like Arbor House or Tabor Lodge or one of these sort of services. Problem with those sort of services is you can't access them instantly. There is about, I think for Arbor House at the moment, is about a 6 or 7 or 8 week waiting list. Tabor Lodge is probably longer again. And some of these places don't like them on anything at all or won't take them till they're completely clean and off everything, and that can be an issue in its own right. It's a crisis at the moment. Every GP in this town, every GP in every town in the country has a problem with patients on prescription drugs. We're part of the problem. We prescribe the drugs, but it just becomes an issue initially when somebody presents with a back pain or some sort of pain somewhere. You give them some painkillers, usually something like Salpadol or Ixprim or Tramadol or one of these things, and you think that's it. But then they come back and the pain is worse. Then you investigate the pain. You can't really find any sort of reason for the pain, but they need more painkillers and they need stronger painkillers. And then they start getting painkillers off friends, and then they start getting muscle relaxants or Valium-like drugs off friends, and you're into a total crisis. It's extremely difficult because once you approach this topic with any patient, they get very indignant with you. They say, oh, of course I'm not. It's my pain. My pain is my problem. You just won't give me the drugs. And it becomes a huge issue. So rather than having it become very confrontational like that, you really have to sort of have a good rapport with the patient to be able to get them around, to be able to recognise, look, there's a problem here. We need to deal with it. And even in being able to deal with it, the best way probably to deal with it is slow reduction of the prescribe the painkillers, but slowly reduce them on a sort of a phased basis. But it has to be slow. If you do it quickly, it will fail. I'm sort of convinced that there's an addict in every single one of us, certainly in the Irish population. If life goes against you, you know, or if your job is going against you, we're badly affected. We're very badly affected. But I have to say, and I know this from being on drug committees, that we're no worse than most small towns in Ireland. We always think we are, but we're actually no worse. There's the exact same problems in nearly every town in Munster. That's not to say that we don't have a problem. We absolutely do have a problem.
I was 13 and I ran away from home. Yeah. Sexually molested. and I just carried on from there, smoking a joint, taking a drink, then cocaine, heroin, one after another. This company smoked a joint, this company smoked crack, heroin, you know, just different company along the way. You meet different people along the way in your life. And as my mother always said to me, no, sorry, my grandfather always said to me, show me your company and I tell you what you are. Then you get so stuck into it, it's hard to get up. I'm finding it hard to get up anyway. I go to the off license at 10:30 to get an Agnew vodka because that helps with the sickness a little bit. Gives you that little bit of energy that I'm lacking. I come here to Pent Katrina, sit in the park and just fall asleep at the end of the road. Might sit down begging, tapping money because I'm sick. I used to inject, but I think it's easier on the tinfoil than the injecting, you know. I was sitting there yesterday and there was people injecting into each other's neck. I overdosed in front of me yesterday as well, and oh, it's horrible, you know. He was literally crying out for fucking help. Please get me off the ground. That's all he was saying, get me off the ground. Five injections they gave him just to bring him down.
We find a lot more people are presenting with addictions, you know, especially drugs. When you speak to them, they'll tell you that it takes so long to get assessments and it takes so long to get into a place that they've really kind of, they're going downwards all the time. And I just feel that more now has to be done, because the problem has reached crisis in that lying on the streets, they're having seizures, they're collapsing, they're just falling down, they're taking drugs openly, and none of it seems to be getting any better. It's getting much, much, much worse. The Gardaí have a hard time trying to monitor and control the situation, but it's growing, and it's growing very big, and we can't help the people that are afflicted at the minute with the addictions, because they need to be, a lot of them need to be helped straight away. So I believe that if we had centres for people to walk in and present to say, I need help now, and that if they could be taken at that particular time and something done for them, rather than having them wait, because they'll still use up until the time that they get into some place, and they'll keep using and using, and obviously it is getting much worse. And then again, we could lose them between the time they have their assessment and the time that they go into some place. It's becoming the norm now in the city. You just walk down the city and it's everywhere, and nobody seems to bat an eyelid anymore. But on the other side of it, then a lot of people genuinely care, and a lot of people want to help, and they want to do some stuff for people. So I don't think there would be any issue with putting centres in the inner city at the minute for people to come in and for professionals to be there to help them. And they would have some glimmer of hope then.
I'm out of the heroin addiction, which I picked up when my mum had leukemia inside jail in the Midlands. I was on that until she died, and then the day she died, I snapped over. I was on Xanax, I was on everything. I went from weed to tablets and weed, because they took the anxiety away. Started getting into trouble, girls when we had a very young age. Because I was dealing, like, I was one of these people that didn't like authority, didn't listen to authority, like, just had no time for authority, really. Like, I wish I did, like, you know what I mean? And then I wish I finished school too, which is another bad thing, like, because I've been on mushrooms and they fried my brain.
I must tell you a little bit about my sister. I suppose she was the life and soul of the party. Just an absolute beautiful person, I suppose. Saw the best in everybody. The light was really came on for us when it was the day after Stephen's Day, and I got a phone call to say that my sister was in the intensive care unit in the CUH. And it was just like, I don't know what it was like. Everything crashed in. I don't even remember getting from Meath to Cork. And when I went in there, my father said, "You've it all wrong. That is no way." There was heroin in her system. There was methadone. There would have been other, I can't remember now, diazepam, them kind of stuff in her system. And he was saying, "No, that's no way is that our daughter, my sister." And I suppose it absolutely hit me like, I don't know, it was just heartbreaking, devastating. My perception of somebody on heroin would have been somebody that would have been homeless, dirty, just, I suppose, useless, I suppose. I don't know. But to see it happen to your own sister, it's just, it's, I can't explain. I suppose not to see, it and to try and process it. And it's just, it was just heartbreaking. Thankfully, she came out of it. I suppose that was probably, that was the time there was definitely a break in the family. And the family has never been the same since. She was functioning day to day. She had a son. She was a functioning mother, and people are really, really good at covering up what they want to cover up, I suppose, really.
I have to see somebody sort of in the surgery maybe once a week when they're in trouble. Early stages, maybe twice a week, even every day. But they're living with them. And that is so, so hard. Because as you know, sort of addicts, they'll lie, they'll cheat, they'll do anything to get their drugs. They will tell you they're clean when they're not clean. They will do everything. And they suck the good out of everybody. And I can sort of sit in the surgery and sort of get annoyed and feck them out of it or whatever, you know. But family just have to keep turning up. Family have to keep listening. Family have to be there. And it's very, very, very difficult.
There's not enough done. They need to, like, need to say more about it. They need to say that it's, like, it's really bad. It's going to, like, mess you up and everything. Put people off them all together.
Yeah, I think there'd be, like, if they had more, it'd be even better. Like, they'd put you off, put people off even more.
Yeah, I would say there should be more done, but, like, I don't feel like it's going to make a difference to people whether they want to do it or not, or it's going to stop them. But I feel like it'll educate them more and, like, how to be safe.
Yeah, I feel like the teachers are trying their best, but you can only do so much. Like, the teenagers aren't really going to listen to other, to teachers.
Try to do their best, like, they can't really do much more.
When Table Lodge first opened its doors in the late 80s and into the 90s, the 1990s, it was seen that the typical client is going to be a middle-aged man who's alcoholic. But since that time, the availability of illegal drugs has become greater in Ireland and in Cork, so on from there. That's continued to be the case. And so it is now to be expected that resident in Table Lodge who is, say, between the years of 18 and 35 years of age will be addicted to alcohol and also will be addicted to other substances as well. The favourite other substance, top of the list of the other substances, is cannabis. A lot of people who develop addictions will be using a lot of cannabis, using it in a recreational way, but maybe they're also addicted to cannabis. Cocaine is very prevalent in Cork. It has been now since the late 90s, but it's particularly so now. Like a typical client in Table Lodge in 2018 is a young man in his 20s or his 30s, who really has been brought to his knees because of excessive cocaine use. Something else we're also noticing a big increase in the use of is benzodiazepines, typical anti-anxiety kind of medication that people are getting on the street or from the internet. Across-the-counter medications and other prescription medications of the pain-killing type, like opiate-based medications, and also opiate-based illicit substances, is also on the increase in people presenting to Table Lodge for help with addiction. When people come to Table Lodge and talk about addiction in their family, there usually is addiction somewhere in their family. It's not common for that person to be the only person in the family system where there is addiction. So from that point of view, there's some sort of a genetic component to this. The main origin of it, though, I think, is somebody has something upsetting them in the first place. something that isn't sitting right with them, something that disturbs them, something that hinders them. Some of the substances people are using are highly addictive. The quality of the substance is not regulated. So somebody is putting a very potent substance into a very delicate and sensitive body system, and it causes damage and it causes serious cravings, and the person becomes very dependent on illicit substances. Some of them are extremely potent, and so the person gets into trouble much quicker. And then if the substances are illicit, then the person is breaking the law to become addicted to the substance. The impact is more pronounced and more severe. Like, the family's tolerance of a family member with an alcohol addiction is much higher than a family's tolerance for a member who's heroin addicted, because it is so severe, and the consequences are so much more serious, and the impact on the family are so much more dramatic, that the tolerance isn't the same. And so the young drug addict has a much more difficult predicament than the young alcohol-dependent person.
I've never been to a treatment centre. I just go in and tell the judge, fuck off, just to get into prison. Yeah, that detox, they give you, it's only a stupid few painkillers and something to sleep at night. But they get you well, and you know, you start eating properly, you start back into a routine. You know, your routine is good. You know, baby steps with them. When you come out, you do it all over again. You know. It'd be nice to get treatment. It'd be nice to walk in somewhere and just say, yeah, that's great. I'm not going to be sick today. I knew exactly what I was doing. Giving the guard cheek, or telling the judge fuck off, or telling the DPP to fuck off. I knew exactly what I was doing. I need to smoke today. Oh, I have these clothes on a week, I'm just not able to look at the dirt to me. That's not even funny, like, look at this. Do you know what I mean? I'd love to change clothes. Even something simple like that make you feel good. A shower make you feel good. Of course I do. Oh well, I'm not. I'll have to go down outside the shop here now and sit down with a cup in front of me. Might be there for 3 or 4 hours. And it's the dirtiest drug you can ever meet. It's cheap, but it's dirty. And I suppose 20 euros is not cheap when you don't have it. 20 euros is a lot when you don't have it. It's horrible. Probably have to go prostitute myself out tonight. So I woke up very sick this morning. I never went out, made money last night, but I possibly will do it tonight. Stand there. They all go around in their cars. And, you know. Sad life. That river is very calling anyway. I'd be in it only if I could swim. I'd be gone long ago only if I could swim. It's just natural when you jump into the water, you obviously swim. You know. I'd be in it long ago. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen today. I don't know. I can't sleep beyond the next hour. I don't know what's going to, I don't know where I'm going to be in the next hour. I can't anyway. And whoever says I can, they're fucking lying. Do you think I want this life? I don't want to look at me and walking with the dirt. That's not life. That's not life. I know what a good life can be because I had a good life. I know what it can be. You know? I had it. Just the addiction took it away. And only for the half those homeless people in town, I wouldn't be here today. If they pick you off the ground and they'll make sure you're warm if you're sleeping on the ground.
Avoid it at all costs, like, because I was, like, going from, like, yeah, I was drug dealing at the time, but like, I would have copped on, you know, as I got older, like I did, like, you know what I mean? It's just, when I got on that drug, it doesn't matter how good of a person you are, what character you are, like, you need to get better from that drug, and you will do anything to get better for that drug, with not anything, like, we all have our morals, like, but more than likely anything
So that's how I ended up in jail. I lost my child. Like, I don't get to see my child anymore. You know what I mean? That's my baby. Like, I was with my girlfriend for 7 years. Like, if you don't have your fix, you will go work for it. Like, you will go get the money. Believe me, you will get the money. No matter what way, you'll get the money for your fix. Because you feel sick as a dog. There's no worse. You can't even describe the pain. Like heroin users have to come off. If there was no, like, I remember when there was no methadone at McCall Prison. It took me 4 months to get better. 4 fucking months, and they say, come out your it comes out of your system in 3 days. It's ruined my life, like, never again. This is how low I went. I was robbing my mother's medication. And she on cancer. I was robbing money out of her fucking purse to get my fix, to get my bag. She was giving me money at one stage to get better, and there's crack now around as well. I've tried crack. It makes you feel like a 1,000,000%. It only lasts 2 minutes, and you're back to smoking it again. It's 50 euro rock.
Heroin is a very big problem in the area. In the Cork and Kerry region, our Drug and Alcohol Task Force have a very effective heroin strategy, which we devised over 10 years ago now. And it introduced harm reduction services into the region, where people who were heroin addicted could get help and become stabilized on methadone and immediately reduce the harm that heroin addiction was causing. And that remains the case. I don't know what the numbers are of people in the Cork city and county who are availing of methadone maintenance programs. And such people don't come to Tabor Lodge for treatment for heroin addiction, as Tabor Lodge introduces people to drug-free treatment options to reduce the harm that someone is causing themselves and others due to the heroin addiction. So the use becomes safer, more regulated, and the person is not engaged in criminal activities then, and so there's a significant improvement in the person's circumstances, and a significant stabilization happens, and then people are maintained at a certain level of wellness then due to that intervention.
I certainly was never a lover of the methadone program, I have to say. I always felt that, well, you know, we're giving people drugs and we're giving them drugs and we're enabling them to stay on drugs. But I have to say, in the patients that I have who are on methadone programs, it has been life-changing for them. They've given up the dangerous sort of things they were doing in trying to get drugs, in buying drugs anywhere, in using any drugs they could get. And it's allowed them get a degree of control back into their lives. So as I say, from somebody who a few years ago was sort of against methadone program, I now see its merits and I see an awful lot of good in it. I'm still slightly iffy about the fact that it's a maintenance for life a lot of the times. And I'm not so sure about that we should maintain somebody on methadone forever and ever, amen, that we can't do some sort of reduction. But at the moment, it seems to be maintenance for life.
I'm chasing this thing all the time about the methadone, the whole program thing. It's supposed to be maintenance, right? Maintain. But, like, when it came out, it was supposed to be over 2 years, right? And then you would be, over the 2 years, you would be sorted out, assessed, you know, and dealt with, and you'd come down, like, you know, it's over 18 years, like, they say in 18 years, but it was there before that. They have a drug in England and in Europe called Subutex. It's a single tablet. Logic would tell you that a single tablet isn't going to affect your liver and the rest of your body and aura as much as a litre and a quarter or a litre and a half of methadone a week. And logic would tell you that, like. People are plodding along because like, I mean, like, whether they're on 100 mil, whether they're on 50 mil, whether they're on thing, people are plodding along. But there's no, the program isn't being run as it was supposed. Like, that was supposed to be a 2-year program, and then it would be addressed in there, and you'd be within a certain period of time you'd be off it. Not fucking 18 years later or 20 odd years later. This is actually more than 18 years when it came out first. It's, that's just people seem to think it's 18 years, but it's more, you know. And I mean, I'm sure the likes of the people who are supplying the drug. I'm sure they're quite happy. They've got it in all sorts of forms, you know. And as in, they have all sorts of tastes, sugars, things. I mean, they were taken to court there because people's teeth were rotting out of their head, you know, and all the rest of it. Because, you know, now they have this sugar-free gum or whatever, you know. But then you have the different forms of it, like they've got pinidone, thingidone, you know. Apparently, just for people who are at different the amount that you're using, you know, they give you one type if you're only smoking, or 2 bags, 3 bags a day, or whatever. If you're banging up 6 bags a day, you get a different type of methadone, you know what I mean, a stronger one, and all this stuff. And Subutex seems to be the way, without wrecking people's bodies, you know, without wrecking, you know, like, I don't think people understand, like, the fact, like, a litre and a quarter, right? It's about 70 litres a year. And what's happening as well is, like Valium is a muscle relaxant. People say that the methadone, it's not the methadone. It's what happens is they take the methadone, okay? Now, the biggest muscle in your body is your heart, right? Now, Valium is a muscle relaxant, right? So what happens is that when they take the methadone, right, that's fine. But a lot of these people will take 5 D10s in the morning, 5 D10s in the afternoon, you know. And what happens is then, and they might have a couple of pints as well by the evening. And what happens is, because it's a muscle relaxant, it's in the methadone really actually kills them at all. It's the Valium slowing down their heart and forgetting the brain, forgetting to, because the muscle stops working because of the mixture, do you know what I mean? But isn't exactly the methadone, which is the Valium, that actually crosses them over, you know? Why not give them the Subutex, you know? And set a program on that and get it sorted out, you know? And those who can't make it, because you'll always get some who won't make it, but then people have a chance of making it, you know? Whereas they've got no chance with this Maintain for Life program, you know? It's a Maintain for Life, like.
It's worse to come off than any heroin. That's because it gets into your bones. And that's different. Methadone is horrible. I never can go back on it.
Methadone, see, is the best thing that'll ever happen to you, and it's the worst thing that'll ever happen to you. You know? It'll fuck up your teeth, but it'll keep you stable. It'll get you your foundation. Life will get you where you want to be, even though you're on it. It beats heroin any day of the week, but that, like, obviously if you're detoxing, go on methadone for 28 days and leave it at that if you are detoxing, like, because I was on it for like 18 months to 2 years, and believe me, like, the only side effects was a lot of sweat, and I know I fell to the beggar on the street, so I would have ended up back in jail again, like, because I would not go down and beg, like, I'd rather jump a counter or slip a note to a bank teller or something, like, saying, hand out the fucking money, like, you know what I mean? But that'd be my type, like, because I just couldn't go on the floor and beg, like, you know? I really should be dead. How I didn't even know what D is beyond me, like, I must have some people looking down after me, like, because they all fucking died me, like, but, yeah, I should be dead, like, I mean, for me to be even sitting here talking is a shock, like, and for me to have the place that I have, and how my life's changing since I stopped it all, there's no better feeling than being high off life, do you know that? That's a fact, like.
Addiction is not a spectator sport. Eventually, the whole family gets to play.
When all of this happened and that night in the hospital came out, there was definitely a change in things. It was like that she maybe, it was I suppose, how can I say this? It was like that she didn't have to cover up anymore. So I think she definitely didn't care as much. It just escalated, really. It escalated at possibly rapid rate, really, to be honest about it. Having said that, they did try and get as much help for her as possible. But unfortunately, the help isn't there. She needed to I can't remember exactly the figures, but she needed to be down to so much and have so much methadone. And she looked, if they got down to that much, they'd nearly halfway there themselves, which isn't, you know. And my parents looked at places in the UK and stuff like that. But I will say they were very good in Tabor Lodge. She was clean for a period of months. She did try, but unfortunately, the crave for the drug or the love of the drug just passes everything else out. And that is the biggest thing. She told me, she often said to me, I'm really trying, but she said, I just love it so much. But you'd say to yourself then, did she love it? Because she'd have it and she wouldn't even, she'd feel so bad after it then. But it eats into their bones. It eats into every single bit. My sister had absolutely crystal white teeth and you could see towards the end they were getting black. And, you know, that's what it does. It totally rots into their bones. People have tried stuff with the crack and never come out of it. She overdosed twice. So the second time, I think, definitely was a turning point for her. And she really had tried to get herself together. Honestly, she did. And she would have been mainly on methadone at the time. The problem that she would have encountered is that most people that would be on drugs, it's their circle of friends, are on the same. So she was doing really good. Her partner wasn't. So that is a battle in itself. So her texts would have been very clear. Her speech would have been very clear. The night before she passed away, she spoke, sent messages. When somebody is on drugs, they're exceptionally low. They're exceptionally vulnerable. And, you know, there's a huge, huge amount of shame attached to it. And no matter what they say or, you know, they might act, you know, this, but there has to be. Because I've spoken to my sister on numerous occasions and she really did want, she really did. I think that's probably what the heartbreaking part of my for all of us are, more of my mother, because we really saw that she turned the corner and she really wanted to get right and she wanted to help other people, you know, and anyone who has come clean, take my head off to them. And there is people out there who've come clean. But I think it takes a certain unique individual and they need to have all the proper structures around them. And unfortunately, and not knocking the system, but that those structures aren't there. I think they probably will eventually. But I mean, how many lives will have been lost at that stage? Right. In 99% of families that are dealing with addicts, you know, it's really, really, really tough for them. I know that when my sister passed away, they were like, oh, was it that and all that? You know, I don't think I went outside the door for about 3 months. Because, to be honest with you, it wouldn't bother me. I wouldn't be one bit worried about people. But you actually couldn't get over how ignorant people can be and asking absolutely ridiculous questions when really, does it make a difference? She's no longer here. Does it really make a difference? And all what I would say is, for whatever reason, she did what she did, she paid the ultimate price. From the time my sister, I suppose, would have been involved with drugs, would have been a whole period of just over 3 years, which is a very short period for a person in her 20s initially. And just over 3 years later, to be visiting your sister in a grave is just, words can explain it. You look back and you think, what could you have done? Did you do enough? I mean, 23 years of age, and all because of drugs. We were such a close family, and all because of drugs. But I would say to anyone out there, you know, don't even try, because you just don't know. And you know what, can I say something to you? If you need something, you feel you need something like that, you probably need to speak to somebody. You don't need to take something. Really go and speak to somebody, because, you know, and don't believe people put you under pressure, because this is your life. And don't do something that will affect your life because of somebody else.
I suppose I'm someone who can clearly identify as an addict, you know. I started using drugs very young, you know. I started using drugs as 11, at 11, you know. And even before that, I had all the behaviours of an addict. I was just a very dysfunctional young fella, you know. Always in trouble, always, I suppose, the class clown, always trying to fit in and never fitting in anywhere, you know. And I think me becoming the class clown really was because I had no self-esteem, I had no confidence, I was very insecure. So when I found drugs, right, you know, they worked for me, you know, they worked for me. They helped me to fit in, they helped me to opt out from society, which I struggled, you know, I struggled even as a young fella. Whatever I started, like I started with maybe cannabis and maybe petrol and things like that, and I progressed through like ecstasy and coke. I used all of them to excess. At different points of my life, I was using these drugs to my excess, and they all fulfilled the function for me. And I suppose the function was for me that I didn't have to deal with life, that I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to deal, like, I had no self-confidence for living a normal life. And this drug scene, as it impacted my life, I had confidence in this drug scene because I had many low points. Like, my life was always in crisis. And that's what I was used to, you know. I was used to being in one crisis or another every couple of weeks, every couple of months. And I was comfortable with it, like, you know. I was comfortable living in that life. You know, there's a familiarity in it. It's misery, but it's familiar to me. You know, what I had a fear of really was living out in society, like paying bills, being responsible, having a job. You know, all things like that intimidated me. You know, I just had no self-confidence. I felt I couldn't do it. I can live this life. You know, I can take drugs and I can do what I can do to get the money for drugs. And you know, that's what I felt comfortable doing, like, you know. So I had all this coming into recovery, like, you know. I was a drug addict, you know, with all that baggage and all the baggage of the life I've led. But I also came into recovery with this big fear, like, you know, that, like, what's the point of me getting clean, you know? I felt so, my self-esteem was so low, you know, my self-confidence was so low, my self-worth was so low. I was like, what's the point of me getting clean? And I'm only just going to be back at square one without the crutch of drugs and left to myself and my own insecurities and my own belief about myself. You know, I felt like a failure. I'm now living as a member of society today, you know, and life is so much better. My using was very chaotic, you know. It was really bottom of the barrel stuff, you know. It wasn't pretty. I suppose I ended up strung out on heroin. I was on heroin for a long time, you know. I was on heroin for a long time around that city centre. Just living outside society, you know. Just tied to a drug, wanting to give up. I couldn't do it. Getting up every morning. Being sick, going through withdrawals, no hope, you know. You can say society writes you off, like I wrote myself off, you know. I just felt I could never do it. I was never going to get clean. And I was linked in with the services. I linked in with every service that was known to me, you know, and I was after blowing through all of them. My story is a story of relapse, you know. And I suppose what was really important for me at that time, it was the door to Narcotics Anonymous was open to me. It was always open to me. No matter how many times I failed trying to get clean or how many failures I had, I was told keep coming back. And I suppose a big thing for me, you know, like I really felt like a failure, you know, and I felt like people that maybe I knew from when I was younger and people that I grew up with, like, you know, they kind of stood over me, like, you know, around the city centre and things, because I was strung out, you know. I was on the bottom rung of society. It meant a lot to me that members of Narcotics Anonymous helped me at that time, you know, stopped to talk to me, brought me to meetings, didn't judge me, you know. It was very important to me to feel accepted, you know, that this door was open to me. And I walked through it, and it was the best thing I ever did, like, you know.
Narcotics Anonymous is it's a global organisation. It's been around since 1950. In the late 1950s, it was established over in the States. And from being like a one meeting room thing, it's kind of developed to go across 180 different countries. There's meetings in 80 different languages. It is a global organisation. But you know, I suppose for the addict on the ground, for the person with a drug problem, for the person who may be asking themselves that question, do they have a problem or whatever else, the corporate stuff doesn't really matter so much. So NA is completely free. We're open to everyone, regardless of age, race, gender, religion, lack of religion, socioeconomic group. We don't discriminate on any grounds. Everyone's welcome at our groups. And the mantra within the group is that the newcomer is always the most important person. I think NA is built on the foundation that we only keep what we have by giving it away to others. And we believe that the therapeutic value in one addict helping another is without parallel, you know. So, I mean, just if anyone happens to be listening and they're having a problem now and they're in the southern area, sort of Cork, Munster, there is a phone line they can call. It's 087-138-6120. And in terms of meetings, like in Cork City, for example, there's at least one meeting every day of the week. So we've three on a Sunday, there's three on a Monday, there's two in town on a Tuesday. All of this information is readily available. Go on to the website, na-ireland.org. My journey into addiction isn't really it's not the typical story, I suppose, that people would expect. I did reasonably well at school. I came from a very, very good home. You know, it was a lovely environment. Jeepers, we had our problems like everybody else, but none major. You know, I got into university and I got a degree and all the rest, but somewhere probably in around my late teens, and it was the 90s, I started to experiment with drugs. It was very much the culture of the time. I think even tracing a bit further back into my youth, I'd experimented with solvents and gas and petrol. And I don't, looking back, and I didn't know this at the time, but looking back, I don't ever think I was really happy with myself. I always think I wanted to be a little cooler, a little more attractive to women, a little tougher, a little bit more than what I was. And I thought, you know, through altering my state of mind, really, that could happen. So off I went to the UK, studied. The problems probably started then, looking back, though I wouldn't have recognised it as a problem then. I'd have been sort of using cannabis every day and drinking reasonably heavy most of the time and taking a reasonable amount of ecstasy during that period. But, you know, come the end of it all, I moved on to London. I got a good job. I enjoyed a lot of success in that career. But I suppose the industry I was in, it's quite a boozy industry. So it was great camouflage for someone like me that drank too much. There was lots of young people doing exactly the same. And as sort of success grew and salaries and things, you know, so did my taste for more exciting drugs. And, you know, I make no secret of it that, like, cocaine was a part of my story, you know, and as was alcohol, you know. And for many, many years, I was hiding in plain sight. You know, I wore a suit to work. I went to work every day. Inside, I felt like a car crash. Over time, I kind of thought different things had changed. You know, I changed jobs. My problems came with me. I changed geographical locations. My problems came with me. And I couldn't outrun this problem. And at some point, somewhere in all of this, I missed a lot of the warning signs along the way. You know, drinking earlier and earlier in the week, drinking earlier and earlier in the day, using strong drugs when it wasn't the weekends. And eventually, all of this sort of blurred into one marathon, sort of using all the time session. And my sense of self-worth had fallen from low to very, very low. I was starting to notice that my career was being compromised. My relationships at home were getting compromised. My friendships were governed really by who I could use socially with. And bit by bit, my life shrank and shrank until it felt really like I was on my own. Mentally, I was exhausted from the whole thing. Spiritually, it was completely empty. And I wanted a way out. And I tried and tried on my own. I made myself promises, wrote myself lists, goals, targets, letters. And it was just like firing a pea shooter at a row of tanks. I wasn't able to stand up to the addiction that had a grip on me. I just, no matter what I tried. And because I wanted to do it on my own, each time I failed, it was another reason to berate myself and I give myself a tongue lashing and let that inner critic run wild. And it was a tough, tough place to be. And, you know, if anybody ever is in that tough place, like, I hope to God, maybe through programs like this, that they realise there is somewhere you can go. There's Narcotics Anonymous. There's other fellowships for gambling addictions, food addictions, whatever else there is out there. And there's people that are really, really willing to help. I spoke to a drugs counsellor actually over at Arbor House, and he had mentioned a few different options to me, but, you know, the only one that sort of resonated was going to an NA meeting. And even at that, I thought I didn't qualify, you know. I thought, you know, I'm not homeless. I'm not using a syringe. I've got a job. You know, maybe I'm not bad enough to be in this place, you know. And I also sort of was thinking, geez, what type of people await me in these rooms? What sort of broken souls were there? And I got a massive shock on arrival, because the most broken person in the room really was me. You know, the other people that were there had stopped using and had found a new way of life. Many of them were much, much younger than I were. Many of these people were in their early and mid-20s. And what shocked me even more was the amount of help that these people were willing to give to me. I was made very, very welcome. At the end of the meeting, people gave me a hug, shook my hand, thanked me for coming along, asked me how I was doing, told me to keep coming back. And from the very empty, very alone place that I was in, where certainly no one in pubs or clubs or anywhere else was telling me to come back at the end of those nights, it was nice to have a welcome.
There are a huge amount of gaps out there, and it's the gaps that everybody's fallen through. So we have to address that issue. We have to address the gaps. And we have to make them solid. They're not solid enough, because if they were, we wouldn't be having the problems. Obviously, there's something wrong in the system for us to be having the problem that we're having. And here in Cork, in the county, everybody kind of knows each other. It has that community feel to it. Cork, you don't kind of get lost in it, because somebody will know somebody belonging to you. You know, we're losing, like, our community is like our family, our extended family. So when we lose somebody, it's like that we've lost somebody out of that extended family as well. And it hurts everybody. It hurts because they're so young when we're losing them. It's help they need, big time. And that's what we have to give. And we have to go above and beyond to deliver this help, to make this help available, to make them understand that it is here and we will help you. Because when they're in the throes of addiction, sure, they're only worried about the next fix that they get. That's what addiction does. And so it's difficult for them. But I mean, there's not an addict that you'll speak to who will tell you that they love being an addict. They'll tell you they don't want to be an addict.
Cork City is not a bad town. It's huge. You know, the heroin out were fucking destroyed. And crack. Stay in school. College, live your life. You know, be happy. But it don't work out that way for everybody to do it, unfortunately. Otherwise it'd be a very boring world. Unfortunately, I'm stuck in the height of it. I'm going to become dead somewhere. That's the reality. Yeah, I need somewhere to go today, because I'm sick, to get something. I'd love to get well. Be great.
If anyone needs help, they need it now. If I had my head split open today and I was bleeding, it's no different. They're both illnesses. Because you know what? That day that I, if I need help that day, you know, from knowing an addict and knowing other addicts. It might be this, that thing that they take too much or they can't cope and they overdose and die. Really, and I suppose, you know, that's where I suppose the definition, I suppose, from some people feel, oh, sure, that they got themselves there. Yes, they did. But nobody went out there and said, oh, that's what I'll do with my life. There should be a day centre. There should be something there. Because if you need help, you need it today. And you know what I think for an addict, and speaking with my own sister, there was very few times that she asked for help. And when she asked for it, we did our best, but we couldn't get it for her because she needed to be clean. So I'm not going to say less than a handful of times she asked for help. And when they ask for help, they need help. A lot of them, I feel, could be saved if they're caught early enough in that sense. I think the process is too long. And I think the people in there are fantastic. No two ways about it, I think. But they're tight with resources and their hands are tight, you know, that kind of way. Their hands are very much tight. Could you have done more? Those questions never go away. Ever, 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 ever go away. It just totally broke our family. And you know what the saddest thing of it all is? She had the biggest heart and she never meant anything by it. I suppose when you are an addict, you know, we know that she robbed things. She'd rob something then and then she'd go and help an old woman cross with her shopping. Do you know that kind of way? Like, I suppose the hardest thing about somebody that is an addict is that they've no control and it totally consumes them and it's just heartbreaking. I think that it's so heartbreaking. It's 6 years now down the road and it's just, you know, sometimes it's best you don't think about it, because when you do think about it and you think of what she did or what she went through, and when she was out there, was she beaten up, or You think of all the bad things, because it is associated with that. It's totally associated with that. And then you have members of the family who are in denial, members who don't want to know, and then there's always the two or three who tried to keep it together.
There's also the issue of drug debts and intimidation of families to pay drug debts as a huge source of stress for a family unit. As the person becomes more addicted, the fact that they can't actually afford the substances is not relevant to them. They're just addicted to the substance. So they might run into debts with drug dealers, or they might be recruited into drug dealing themselves in order to be guaranteed of a supply, or in order to get their hands on a lot of extra cash, and that causes the person to be sucked deeper and deeper into the whole addiction cycle. There's no doubt that education has a role to play in preventing people from getting into problems in the first place. But even after somebody has gotten into serious trouble with drug use and misuse and drug addiction, education still has a key role to play, because the person doesn't see how it all works, you know, doesn't appreciate what dependency on a tablet or on a powder or on something that they're smoking. So there's education needs to be present all the way through, on ongoing learning and education about the dangers of drug use. But I think there's something even more important than education, especially with regard to preventing drug addiction problems in young people. And that is the whole mental health of young people, how well young people are, how good are their relationships and the communication in their relationships, especially with caring adults. And that's a much better indicator of a young person who's going to be kept safe from the dangers of drug and alcohol addiction, is that they're well in themselves.
We tell people, no, you should not use drugs, but I do think you have to have safety in place when they do use drugs. I certainly think the idea of going off for the weekend to whatever concert, wherever, you know, friends keeping an eye on who's taking what, is a very, very good idea. No, you don't want parents sort of down on children all the time, okay, or down on teenagers all the time, because teenagers will just rebel to that. But I think you need to know where they are, you need to know what they're doing, you need to know who they're with. And I think that makes a huge difference. And I mean, there's only three basic rules when you're dealing with kids and a fear of drugs, and that's keep the lines of communication, keep the lines of communication, keep the lines of communication open.
I just want to say to people, if you're thinking about it, I swear, don't go there, like, because you'll rob your mom, you'll rob your aunt, and you expect, you think everybody believes your lies, like, when they don't, they can see how skinny you're at again, that your legs are like fucking paper thin, you know, and you get people, like, that used to be afraid, yeah, like, looking up to you, like, coming up to you saying, who are you looking at, you know, you're saying, what the fuck is going on here? Because you look at yourself and you see nothing has changed. They look at you and they see, like, oh my God, he's ruined looking, like, you know what I mean? If you don't build a routine, it'll be very hard to get off the ground. You have to have foundation first, like, somewhere to live. And then you need to build a routine. Once you have that routine, keep that routine, and things will, doors will start to open for you. And the more you go to places like the gym and socialise with better people, more doors will open.
If you want to come to a meeting, and if you, one of the members will come and meet you and bring you to your first meeting if you ring the NA helpline, you know, just to get you in that door, like, you know. I suppose the primary purpose of any NA meeting is to, I suppose, help people with recovery, and I suppose you... You're on about that. I came to NA. I was still using when I came to NA. You know, the only desire for membership is the desire to stop using. The number is 087-138-6120.
They don't want to be an addict. They also know they can't help themselves, they need help. And it's just that road. We have to clear everything on that road for them and give them a chance. What do we need to do to fix this? Are people's lives not worth it? I think they are. Like, we have lots of people who are in recovery and they're in a happy place and they're striving hard to keep that happy place, you know, and they're motivated and they have hope, they have belief in themselves.
In the last 5 or 6 years, there's been at least one or two deaths every year from drugs. And that's tragic. That's 12, 13, 14 people who should be here who aren't here anymore.
We would like to sincerely thank Dr. Declan Matthews, Mick Devine, Katrina Toomey, Joey X and the students from Pubble Skull na Tráthnóna for their invaluable contribution in this programme. And to Anita, Darren, Mary X, Peter and Martin for their honesty in relaying their personal stories. This programme is dedicated to all those still fighting their battle and in loving memory of those who lost their battle.
This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. Produced and presented by Yvonne Smith. Edited by Thomas O'Keefe. A Community Radio Yall production.